Hey everybody, episode number 240 of Shop Talk Show. We got some stuff in here like, what if you were tasked to make a gigantic online form, like something super big, an online mortgage application form? How would you go about doing that? We have one in here about picking out a CMS that you intend to hand off your client for them to update. Stuff we've talked about before, but Dave and I talk about which ones would we pick that have been piquing our interest lately and some recent experiences in both. We're just going to say the words atomic CSS and then just talk about it and have our thoughts on that whole universe. I should mention that this show is brought to you in part by Hired.com. Please go to Hired.com/ShopTalkShow. For doubling your signing bonus if you take a job through Hired.com. The jobs come to you on Hired.com. It's really cool. We'll tell you more about how that works later on. We have another question about like super mega menus and what happens when they start to become fragile and hover-based and We coin a new Shop Talk Show rule, too, during that question. And then what about hosting? Like, what makes a host slow? What makes a host fast? What capabilities are there on hosts and stuff? We start out the episode with that, so stay tuned. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shubamaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Beep Boop Beep Shop Talk Show. I'm a robot today. Why? Why did I choose this, Chris? I can't undo it. I'm Dave.
Well, I've been trying to figure out your algorithm for what you're going to choose to do right in this moment for years, and I don't know.
It randomizes about 10 seconds in. Into the intro. It's like, that's when my random intro generator kicks on. And so that's the podcast you have downloaded in your podcatcher of choice. Hi, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Hope your drive to work is going good. Watch out. That guy just tapped their brakes. Careful there. This is a virtual reality experience. You're in the Shop Talk driving simulator.
I was thinking earlier that there may be opportunity to do a little mouth coding as well. So I was like imagining people driving in their cars and being like, I wonder how, like, have we ever done a good job? You know, when you're like, oh, imagine this, it's div with a data attribute. And the data, you know, like a dashed data attribute, and the value is 35 pixels, and you're trying to get it out, but you need to remove the quotes. And it's like, I don't know.
I wonder like how many accidents Shop Talk has caused because of that.
You're just really trying to visualize code. I hope none.
I hope everyone's driving safe. I hope you got, you know, the Tesla autopilot on. I hope everything's going great.
So it's a rapid fire, as we've been doing here lately. There's some questions coming up in a moment that I wish we had a guest for, but we just don't because we're just a little lazy this time of year. It's fall. It's getting crisp. It makes me want to lay on my couch. Anyway, here's one from Simon McLean. Hey, guys, I have a question about hosting. I'm currently hosting two personal projects. One's a traditional website, my portfolio. I wonder what traditional means when people say that. HTML, CSS? I don't know.
Yeah, it was put in, like, quote-unquote, traditional. So, server-side rendered, I believe.
Probably. And the other is a React-based web app. Both of these are hosted at a single GoDaddy account. This presents two problems. I feel like GoDaddy is kind of slow. It doesn't provide a node environment, which means I can't do all the isomorphic JavaScript goodness. So is there any competitively priced hosting option that works well for both traditional sites, which utilize PHP and MySQL, as well as for node-based web apps? I have some questions here, too. One is that, I mean, hosting is such, like, you know, I don't know if this is, like, offensive to hosts or not, but I think most hosts generally agree with this, though, to be honest, is that it's kind of a commodity product. In that there's so many hosts and there's so many options and it's just such a kind of standard thing to offer that any given host isn't like particularly much quote unquote faster than the next host. And most speed is just kind of on you for how you configure the kind of the commoditized hardware that they're providing for you. They're certainly not like throttling your speed or anything like that. But there is a certain inherent speed to hardware. So if you have like a server that just has a really slow processor on it or something, it might be slower. If you're on a box that's shared by tons of people, that might be slow or something. But it's not just like brand name host equals slow, different brand name host equals fast. It's just not that simple.
Yeah. And I mean, there are some hosts that will sleep your instance, you know, power you down so you're not taking up CPUs on the server that you...
I'm sure it depends on the plan and how much you're...
Yeah. Well, and you absolutely like share a server with people. Like even like a $500 a month thing, you're like sharing it with other people. So
for sure. I would think dedicated servers start at many thousands of dollars
a month. Yeah. I guess did we finish the question? I guess they're saying,
well, that's slowness, but I mean I have more questions on this. So many hosts, you know, and we've talked about this, I'm sure, many times, install some stuff by default because you're probably going to need it, you know, like you fire up, it's your average level, even like $20 a month hosting or cheaper, probably gives you PHP just is automatically installed on there and running and stuff because you just, it's just, I think people just kind of expect that at that level. I expect to be able to install WordPress on this thing and have it work. I better get some MySQL databases because I may or may not use them, but they might as well be there kind of thing. That's been commoditized as well. And it's actually a bit rare to be sold a server for rent that just has nothing at all on it. Mm-hmm. And if you want that, it's generally it's less of a commodity price. It's more of a, okay, we're going to rent this, but we're making sure that you know that you have to do everything on this thing. It's a totally blank box. So, okay, cool. What do you need on a server to run Node? Like, if you buy one of these, like your average $20 banger hosting plan, can you run Node on it, or is it on you to SSH in there and do whatever you need to do to install Node? Node doesn't seem like it's as commoditized as a, or whatever. Maybe commodity isn't the right word there, but as like default installed thing.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's like, well, I guess it depends. You know, let's start where Simon is kind of from. Like, he's hosting on GoDaddy right now. I will say, like, I don't know anyone like hosting on GoDaddy. So I think you could, it might be like feel good to make a move. For traditional sites, like just whatever blogs or static sites or whatever, I think any server will work. But yeah, you get into like Node, you need like Node installed. If you can command line in and install it.
Now that I'm Googling around a little bit, just for the record, so we don't sound like total idiots here, there's GoDaddy. They even have a $5 a month plan. Apparently, there's a one-click thing. You go into their interface, and if you want Node installed, you just click a button, and it will do.
Oh, there you go.
So that's them. I imagine things like, you know, in Media Temple Zone by GoDaddy, they probably have some kind of similar situation, or at least documentation on how to do it. Or they might have documentation that says SSH in and install it yourself.
Yeah, I like Media Temple brand loyal, call me a brand loyalist, but it works. They do give you things like Plesk and all these things to manage your server. If you don't want to manage your server and you want to use something, I don't know, like where somebody else manages it and you just kind of like cruise into it and like push to it, I use Heroku quite a bit. Heroku's pretty good. It supports Node. It'll detect your Node app and do that. You know, DigitalOcean is another good one. Like you just set up a Node droplet or whatever and you push to that.
Because of their droplet thing, you just pick a Node one and then it's ready to go.
Which is probably the same thing as going into GoDaddy and clicking Node. You know,
it is. And on Media Temple, it looks like they do just have docs here. They ask you to SSH in and it shows you all the commands and stuff that's necessary to install node on the thing. All these things down to the metal are doing the same thing. It's just how convenient do they make it for you.
Right.
Some people might prefer to SSH in because they're just command line kind of people and they just like the down to the metal feeling of that. So there probably are some hosts though in which you can buy hosting from them and they don't even give you SSH access or pre-install node, meaning it's not even possible to run.
I'm thinking like a Dreamhost or something. They probably do, you know, don't email me, but I think they, you know, it's not like easy or advertised to do that or something.
Right. Or it's a higher level plan in which that you need to do that. But Simon also says that, so just to be clear on this, you know, one's a traditional website, like you said, and another is a React-based web app. Now, React is JavaScript, but it does not require Node. It's client-side. Mm-hmm. So any hosting account could handle that.
Yeah, you could just have a PHP, what Apache with like an index.php to do that if you wanted. But
so he says isomorphic. What okay. I mean, I don't know.
That means know. That is, means is server that the thing rendered that's and client rendered, like both. Like.
Okay, so it's like I want to build this React app, but I want to do the progressive enhancement thing with it, and so if JavaScript is off, the server still runs the React and sends the results of that.
Yeah, there's like a like. There's a function in React DOM, I guess, or maybe it's just React, but it's render to string, where you can just basically take whatever your React app was gonna like calculate or whatever, you just render it to a string, and it's pretty actually easy. There's a 24 ways article, 24 ways. Remember that blog?
Yeah, coming up, I bet.
Yeah, I guess like it's a full, but there's a universal React. Post on there by Jack Franklin, and there's also like a bunch of Git repos you might want to check because they're probably a little more up to date. But I found this to be a really good intro to React, but also B, like how to like intro to making it work on your server. And
even that I imagine isn't as simple as, well, you just, you know, just render it to string and then have the server send it out. Because it's like, I can imagine writing a React component that's full of, like, button elements and stuff. And, you know, like, if you're trying to solve for a completely JavaScript-off experience on the web, you have to write it with proper anchor tags and stuff still.
Well, so it'll, like, basically, like, render out whatever the, like, whatever React thinks the URL is and then hand it off to React whenever like it goes full client side. But there is things like where you load, like in a React app, you have, you know, component did mount, component will mount, component unmounted. You know, it has this like, it's called a life cycle. And then a render is kind of the final function in the structure. And it really matters where you put things like, so if you don't actually request your data until component did mount or something like that, or set the state, it'll render basically just hot links to the render function and spits that out. So if that helps, like if you're familiar with React, it basically like renders a kind of naked component.
But I mean, anything that you're depending on a click for in there ain't gonna happen. So whatever that click,
it'd be like if somebody function. Deep linked into that view,
right?
It would try to spit it out. But this one actually only covers the index, like spitting out some of the in. Well, maybe it actually does more. Anyway, it's cool. This app, check out this 24 ways. I'll drop a link in the show notes, but it kind of helped me understand how it all works together.
All right, what do we got?
Keith Weiland, longtime listener of the show, writes in, is it acceptable to reduce the technically accessible functionality of a complex mega drop-down whiz-bang navigation?
That was quite a sentence, Keith.
Not a single comma in there, Keith. let's see. For example, the business told the designers they want a navigation that, when hovered, shows drop-downs and flyouts on the second, third, even fourth level of navigations. You're four levels down. I built it by starting with Adobe's accessible mega menu JavaScript so that all the key bindings and ARIA attributes were there along the way. to accommodate this particular nav's design. I heavily modified the JS and it's gotten quite complex and seems fairly fragile. Is it okay if I were to just make the top level items accessible, focusable, and only expose the dropdowns and the flyouts with normal mouse behavior, especially if each subpage of those websites is guaranteed to have the same navigation links in the content as those available in the top navigation. As always, love the show. Thanks, Keith.
I've heard that before. It's kind of like, oh, if there's a dropdown, it's okay because you on a device that doesn't have hover behavior, you can still click to the subpage, and then the subpage will have further navigation. And that subpage, you can click onto a third level page, and then the fourth level page. And I kind of don't like that. And then it's like it feels like quite the penalty for a non-sided
hover
device
kind of thing. Or or non-hover. Like guiding principle for me, at least for accessibility, is try to give equal content to equal users, right? like don't be like, oh, these people can't see, they want a totally different thing. That's like that. It's tough because like you think you're like, oh, I could just shortcut everything by making this super easy, by like just forcing them to a page. But like in the spirit of like, I give the same content to all people. I would throw a yellow card here and just say you got to make it work or try to as hard as you can. But to Keith's point, that he's at like four levels of navigation. So you go like products, and then you're like product family A, product family A 2016, and then you're at product, you know, family A product A. You know, it would be like very, very, I don't know. When you get into
it's hard,
these situations,
it sucks to feel dogmatic and be just like, oh, four levels? Never.
Never.
Never. Never do it. Because it's not true. I mean, I think of just the last few days as looking at, you know, fall shirts. And it's like, it's not unfeasible for me to want to go to a website and use some navigation that's like clothing, men's shirts or whatever, you know. So it's like, right, by that time you're four levels deep kind of in a flyout kind of thing. And I want to do that because I want to jump right to where I need, and I know that there's just a zillion products on this H&M website or whatever it is. So it's not, you know, don't be like, oh, four levels, throw it away and start over. There's other stuff to dig in here too. I like that you apparently Adobe has some accessible mega menu open source thing that they put out there. I would trust that. I think that's cool. It's certainly when you're building a very complex navigation, you do need to think about how it's used. And you, so I love the idea of starting with something that already works well. And it sounds like you are in agreement with that, Keith. But also that something crazy has happened here and that you've had to, you know, modify the crap out of it. And now you say it seems very fragile. We could probably have like Shop Talk Law 19. If it seems fragile, it is fragile.
that's actually beautiful. Chris's law, Coyer's law. If it seems fragile, it is fragile. That's where I'm getting at. It's like, if it's fragile in your code, then it might need to be redesigned. Like, and again, I don't want to be like throw it away, burn it, but it does seem like it's maybe a technical debt problem. You know, how is it working on mobile? Is it just, are you accordioning like four accordions deep? Like, that seems like it might be a user experience issue or something. And then if it's only showing up on desktop, I would be in the like, why are you spending so much time on something that's only for desktop? So I would probably have a, we might need to redesign talk, but those aren't easy. So I mean, I've had clients who are like, we need to have an advertisement in the super mega dropdown, like a paid sponsorship placement. And you're just like, what? Why did you sell that? And they're like, well, it's sold out for the next year. And so you're just like, darn, this is awful. But Sorry, that was a tangent. But
you know what feels good? Like just being like, let's just not use hover site-wide unless it's unimportant. I feel like I went through that process not so long ago, and it's a little tricky because there's spots where you're like, oh, I kind of like hover here. It seems a little faster. It seems a little more responsive. And then just drawing a line in the sand and just being like, nope, you know, we over here on this app, we force you to click on things to open them, including dropdowns, including second level and third level dropdowns, including modals, anything. Click or tap equals the behavior. And it just feels very good once you've like completed that process that everything behaves the same way. You're setting this expectation that I click on it to open it. And so that solves the hover thing, I think. It feels good to be like, okay, no more hover triggered anything. We don't have to worry about that anymore. It's just a matter of shuffling things around to make sure that there's enough room for things and that it's clear how it works on screens of any size and stuff like that. I would think that's kind of would be a decent place to go with this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just make sure it's all click, tap, no hover. 'Cause you run into problems too. I think it's gotten better, I would say, but like with Windows 10 and pointer events and like, you know, like on my Surface, I can use a mouse and tap on the screen and I might do both in the same session. Who knows, you know? So there's a lot to think about. So it has to be kind of as dumb as possible. Like you can't hover such a undependable task or I don't know, event. You really got to be careful. Okay, well, I don't know that we helped. I will say managing ARIA, like ARIA collapsed and ARIA expanded. ARIA expanded. There's no ARIA collapse, right? But ARIA expanded, true, false. Like, it sounds so easy. Like it's just the state. Just say yes or no. But, man, it is so hard. And then the styling based off of that, like, you probably should be styling your menu off of ARIA expanded, true, false. But, like, I don't know a single person that does that, and that doesn't really fit into BEM methodology or whatever. It's a tough thing. It's a non-intuitive thing. And then when you flip ARIA expanded, it doesn't actually hide it. It's still visible. You have to do the CSS, the JavaScript, and the HTML all together in concert. And that seems, can I go ahead and, this may be an unpopular opinion, but it seems like a little bit of a design problem with ARIA that you have to use JavaScript, CSS, and HTML all in concert, to make it work. And, but it's the best thing we have, and it makes sense to computers, so we should probably need to do it. Blah. Blah. That's my official review. Blah. All right. Well, hopefully we helped you, Keith. Good luck. Next question.
We have a real shorty here from Richard Bray, who's writing. He writes in just a topic starter for us to see what we have to say about that. Hi, Chris and Dave. What are your thoughts on functional/atomic CSS trend? I'm a huge fan of it, but I know some people have their doubts. So, topic starter, atomic CSS, I guess we should attempt to define it. This is, you know, it's one that I haven't gotten to on purpose because I was like, in a perfect world, we'd get, you know, some guests on from the project to help talk about it, but whatever. We're just going to do it anyway. I don't even know if this is the best URL for it, but certainly if you Google atomic CSS, you land on acss.io, and it has a pretty good landing page explaining what it is. I think we've brought it up times in the past. I think we've looked at some like Yahoo sites and, you know, told people to, you know, dig around in the dev tools and see this in action. So it's not a totally theoretical thing. There's lots of production websites using this kind of thing. And I guess real quickly, I could try to explain what it is. And I think it's the type of thing that you wouldn't half-ass. You'd go all in on this kind of thing because it's, I think you don't like write CSS anymore, essentially. You style absolutely everything via the class attribute on HTML. And there's this naming convention that says, okay, you need to set the background color on this div. You type BGC as a class name, and then parens. And in the parens, you put a hex code, and there's its own little sub-syntax for how background colors are handled. Same thing for color, same things for padding, margin, anything that you could write in CSS. There's this new syntax, and you put it right in the class attribute of your HTML. So you're like, okay, how can there possibly be classes that, you know, and we know that you can write really weird looking class names and then match that in CSS and have it do something. But there would be theoretically infinite number of classes, right? If you had a class name for height equals 1 pixel, height equals 2 pixels, height equals 3 pixels. Of course, that's, they're not shipping infinite CSS with every web page. There's like a compiler-like program that looks through all these classes that you've written and makes a style sheet that's just what you need, and then ships that. I believe that's how it works. And so there's even, you know, there's variables at play, so you can utilize that a bit like a preprocessor. There are, it handles pseudo elements, it has some built-in grid stuff. It has responsive styles built in, because you just do this like dash dash modifier, and it says only apply this style at certain size. So they've thought about the stuff that people need. Now, it seems crazy, right? It definitely seems like something that you'd be like, why? How? What, like, what problem does this solve? It just seems like a different way to write styles. It seems a little bit like inline styles, really. And I guess the idea is maybe it's more efficient than those, and that at least, you know, it abstracts similar styles into one chunk of CSS. I don't know there, but the idea is that your CSS will never like get away from you. There'll never be this problem, and we get this question a lot on Chop Talk Show. What do I do with unused CSS? How can I trim my style sheets to remove the junk in there that isn't doing anything anymore? Because I'm afraid to do it because maybe it is doing something. I guess you'll never get in that situation. You'll be shipping the minimum amount of CSS absolutely possible to make your site work because the CSS was generated by a computer.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that being appealing. And I think it gets around a little bit of the cascading thing that people like to fight against. They're just like, CSS is dangerous because I write one little thing over here, it cascades to my whole app, it has unintended consequences. Pretty soon there's, you know, Peter from Family Guy pulling on the strings of the thing that everybody loves and hates or whatever. Okay, so atomic CSS does solve some things. I guess that was a big rant. I don't know where to go with that. What are your hot takes?
I'm digging in. I didn't realize. Oh, sorry, I bumped the mic. That's so radio unprofessional. I didn't realize this was like a Yahoo sponsored project, ACSS.io. Like, it's got Yahoo copyrights from last year in the footer. Interesting. I didn't realize, like, you set, like, there's some sort of pre-compilation process that spits things out. Did you know that existed? Like, you put in your colors or whatever. Oh, is this? Oh, okay.
Well, Atomizer is the thing does that work. And I believe this is the part what I'm confused on and whatever, and need people to explain to me, that you don't have to use Atomizer. There's alternatives to that maybe it's like atomic CSS is the concept, and then you can tool around it how you wish.
Okay, and so you kind of like you kind of build your thing. Yeah, I guess Atomizer, it looks like the way they're doing it, like you, like whatever, FZ 20 pics, is font size 20 pics. Like, I think you'd have to run it through some kind of atomizing tool, some sort of compilation tool to get that declaration, that CSS to spit out like font size 20 pics. But, I don't know. Anyway, and I'm also like noticing like Thierry Koblenz's, like, inventor of the, intrinsic box ratio, intrinsic ratio CSS.
I always think of Theory when I think of him, because I think he's either a big involved or a big fan of it.
Yeah, I'm seeing his name on the docs, so that actually, like, That's some like Instacred for me. You judge who doesn't judge open source repos by the contributors list. Here's a petty.
I should point out that if you're thinking, oh, Atomic CSS, that's Brad Frost's thing, right? It's not at all. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. And I even have a post on CSS Tricks, is the atomics of web design, because there's quite a few things that are atomic something. Mm-hmm. So just in case that was confusing, these two things are entirely unrelated.
Even React's like it's like atoms being smashed together or something.
I suppose. Because the React logo is kind of an atom.
Yeah, the logo's an atom.
This isn't 100 miles away from things like CSS modules, which is, or managing your styles the React way through one of the React ways you can do that, of which there are many. So there's plenty. This is in that Venn diagram thing or whatever. If there's a movement towards let's manage our CSS in a totally different, unique way that solves some of these problems, like CSS getting away from you and CSS affecting things that you don't want it to affect, and componentizing CSS. This is in that bucket.
Right. I feel like, so here's my official review. Like, I feel like, you know, you would sit around and you'd write like div class box or something, and your box would be like border color CCC, background color F1 F1 F1, padding 20 pixels or 1 m or something, font color, you know, you kind of like set like a box style, and you're like, okay, that thing is used for this. That's like, it's a single purpose thing. And then somebody else would come along and be like, well, we can make it more single purpose. And like, what if you had a class just to add the border on that, you know, cause maybe you need a borderless box. Okay. So now you have border and box, and then somebody's like, Hey, I'm going to take this to the next logical step, which like every class only does one thing, like Unix philosophy, man. And you're like, well, okay, it's the Unix philosophy. It must be good. And so now you get, you know, a class for every property in your like class list. And to me, Dave Rupert, this is like no different than inline styles. It's just a shorthand for it. Does that make sense? Which can work. It's not illegal, but it's, I don't know. I feel like you have some of the same
CSS stuff.
What's that?
It's just it does seem very much like a shorthand for inline styles. And it does seem like you'd give up on the idea of making, like I said, thousands or infinite classes yourself in CSS. It's the next logical step is, well, okay, let's have the computer make those classes for us. Like, you know, like you wouldn't need CSS all if you actually used inline styles. And I think they're not, the only reason they don't advocate just using inline styles and avoiding all this complexity at all is because you don't get with inline styles things like variables, media queries, you know, automatic kind of grid concepts and stuff. So it's just a step away from inline styles, but it like powers up inline styles a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just, I don't know. This is me. Like I've not been I don't gravitate to this because it seems like you're actually losing the class aspect. I feel like a class kind of by definition, maybe not in computer science, but like a class is sort of like, I do a few things really well. It's like a mix-in, you know, like I do these, this is, if you're using this class, it has these sort of like baseline properties and attributes. When you use Atomic CSS and you say class equals BGC, blah, 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 C, blah, 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 P, blah, blah, blah. Like I think you're listing properties. You're not using classes in the hierarchical sense, but that's maybe more theory.
No,
and that's maybe like,
right, don't you need to just like, I think I've mentioned this before, do you occasionally need to like flip the tables on yourself? It feels weird to argue against this without, you know, being like, well, I've been doing it the same old way forever and it works for me, thus I hate this.
Yeah,
I don't like that way of thinking, and I tend to it myself. Like I look at this and be like, I don't like it. But so, you know, so does everybody about anything ever that's been new. like, do I have a gut instinct that this is the absolute future of how CSS should be written? No, but I'm not like afraid of it. I don't, if I see somebody being productive on it, I'm like, good for you. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'll try it at some point in some product. I just don't want to be locked into a way of thinking that thinks this is garbage.
Hey, if footer class footer hyphen responsive underscore underscore pizza pants hyphen house car is wrong, I don't want to be right. You know what I'm saying? that's a joke I told to
I've been applying classes to my HTML elements since 1995, and I'm not gonna stop now.
Well, I do choose the most appropriate of classes. I would never choose an inappropriate class name. A div class grid.
I've never used an open and close parenthesis in a class name, and I never will.
Div class call one. I would never. That doesn't mean anything to the common man.
You boys ever heard of semantics?
It should be div class major thing, and then it should be using the grid, CSS grid component deal thing, because that's proper. Oh, boy, do we like to come up with things to get upset about in the web industry. Hey!
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Hired.com. The URL you want to use is Hired.com/Shop Talk Show, which will double the hiring bonus that you get from them, normally $1,000 up to $2,000 if you take a job and, you know, find it through Hired.com. Let me back up for a minute, though. What is Hired.com? It's the world's most intelligent talent matching platform for full-time jobs and contract opportunities in fields like engineering, development, design, product management, data science, sales, marketing. They make your job search faster, more focused, more stress-free. So instead of you applying to companies and hoping for the best, Hired puts you in control with how you connect with new opportunities. In other words, the companies contact you with upfront salary information, and you decide who you want to engage with and interview with and such. There are over 4,000 employers on Hired that can potentially be contacting you, from big, huge companies like Facebook to small emerging startups. The size and type of company you want to connect with is totally up to you. They have lots of opportunities in 17 major cities across North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. If you're open to relocation, let us know. They're big on that. Anonymity. is important there too. You don't want your current job finding out you're looking for a new job. They totally handle that. Find your next job on Hired.com, and remember to use Hired.com/Shop Talk Show to double that hiring bonus. Take a job through this link and earn $2,000 for finding your next chapter on Hired.
Brad writes in, I build small to medium sites for clients in addition to my day job. Awesome. Making some side money. I love it, Brad. Get you that Tesla. Treat yourself. I have traditionally used WordPress, as it's what I've the most experience with. But lately on projects I've been working on and the needs of the client, it's almost overkill. I have been messing with Jekyll, and I really like it. I've been wondering if there's any way that the client could update basic information like text, social media links, without messing with Markdown files. I ran across Octopress, but I couldn't figure it out if it would do what I needed. I also came across Grav CMS, which is a flat file CMS, which looks very similar to Jekyll. Long story short, is there any good solution for low-key sites that still need to be managed by the client without having extra bloat or a full-blown CMS?
Yeah, it's just kind of a classic question, I think. Like, give me a CMS that's perfect.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's an impossible question, but... We could take a stab at it probably. In fact, just yesterday I met with one of the people from my gym who's it's a co-op gym, and so everybody just has different jobs and stuff, and the website is like okay, but a lot of it's a little hard to update, and Of course, the original person who designed it and hosted it is now gone, and nobody even knows who's got the FTP information. It doesn't even look like a WordPress site, but I was surprised to find out that it was. It's a self-hosted one, so we're trying to now track down like the FTP information and stuff. But we do have an admin login for the back end of it, and the person we're like, we had a meeting at a coffee shop. They're like, Chris, help me. Change the hours in the footer. There's some hours that are wrong in the footer. And I log in and I was like, okay, it's probably just in footer PHP because it's not like a page or a post or anything. So let's open footer.php, which you can do in WordPress through the editor thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can actually change theme files in there. Thank God. So I go in there, but it's just a they used some really weirdly complicated WordPress theme. I shouldn't say weirdly complicated, but just as like the footer.php file isn't just like some, it's just static text down there when you look at it. But of course, it's managed through widgets, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with using WordPress widgets. That's a good thing. It can make text easier to edit and stuff for people. But these aren't even just regular widgets. These are proprietary custom widgets that this theme like registered, and those widgets are like five folders deep inside the theme folder in some like, you know, component.
This is slash widget
slash ink.
Is everyone else feeling the amount of stress I'm feeling? Okay, keep going.
And so I'm like, so when the widget was registered, it didn't make it editable. It just says, oh, you've put the hours widget here. But in order to change the hours widget, you have to dig way down into the code, and you can't do that through the WordPress editor. It doesn't give you like arbitrary file system access to the depths of the theme folder. So I literally couldn't edit the hours on this friggin' website. Just a simple little text widget in the footer because of the way this theme was constructed and that we don't have FTP access to it. So I'm like, oh, this is insane. So I ended up like removing that widget and just dragging a text widget on there. Mm-hmm. So now the text widget is editable. It's fine. But the one that was there used all kinds of weird classes and stuff. And it used kind of like a BEM thing on like the module and the UL and the LI elements all had classes that were required. And she's like, oh, I don't want to edit HTML. I was like, screw it. We're just going to use paragraph tags here and bold tags, and it'll look a little different, but it'll be fine, you know? Oh, it was such a mess. I was like, okay, someday we're going to redo this thing. I'll volunteer my time. I'm a member of this co-op, Jim. I'm going to do it. So I'm in the same situation that you're in, Brad. I need a CMS. I need it to be kind of simple, but I want everybody to be able to update it. I'm going to like have this list of requirements that's like, whatever we do with this website, I want it to make sure that we're never going to get into this situation again where nobody knows who to talk to, who has access to what, where do you change the hours? And this was just the beginning of it. The hours are actually listed in three different places throughout the site in three different widgets. Oh, it's insane.
Bless. In Texas, we'd say, bless their heart. They really tried to make they made a website.
So what would he do? Like, I'm tempted to so I have to pick one. I'm not going to pick Jekyll because that's just going to cause more problems for somebody, you know, like a gym with shared editing of stuff. That's not the right thing. I still want to have some kind of admin panel where I can give everybody the login to it and they can edit stuff that's really obvious. I'm tempted to pick something. Maybe we'll even pick Squarespace because it's like nobody deals with hosting. It just works. You just log in and you can edit it kind of from the front end of the site. Cause I feel like feels pretty intuitive. Like, oh, how do I edit the hours? Oh, I click on it and I change it and then I save it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Can I give y'all a hot tip? Is this cool? Can we do hot tips? So Jekyll has this Jekyll admin thing, which is cool. But it's still like requires pulling it, installing Ruby, you know, doing like a lot of code and then Git and stuff. But I've used Squarespace. I have a friend who has like a food trailer park website, like he runs a trailer park here in Austin. And he was just like, you know, I just need a website. I was like, let's try Squarespace. And if you need something better, we'll like go to something better later. But this I think will get you off the ground. Use Squarespace. Honestly, mixed reviews. I'm not a huge fan of Squarespace. I think anyone who's used it probably has the same like kind of opinions. It's really limiting. It's really hard to kind of add things and like you can mess with it for a really long time and get it to look right, but it just doesn't like, it's not as easy. Recently, I used a product called Webflow. and to make a website.
Oh yeah, we should almost do a show on this, because I was at the conference and Trent was there, and it's like, you guys did a very like fairly large complicated project in web.
It was like 500 or 1,000 posts and migrations and bad. Wow. Like huge. I like it. And here's what I will say. Like, I generally don't like website builders, like, not a fan. So it takes a lot for me to be like, I would use this, you know, like not only is it like, yeah, it's good, but it's like, I would also use it to like do a client site. And this is all from like, we knew somebody who just, they really wanted to, they had kind of a similar problem. They wanted to update text like without having to procure a development contract in order to update text. And so we shopped around for a long time to like, and like evaluated Squarespace and things. And Webflow just kind of, it's that thing. You can like there's an admin interface, but like where you can like build the whole site in it and stuff like that. And it's actually pretty true to like CSS and stuff like that. So that's great. And it like writes components maybe a little bit differently than I would, but for the most part, it's great. But the killer feature is the like client facing part where they can just walk in, like click on the text they want to edit it, and then publish the changes and it's done. And I think that's exactly what you want. So I don't know. I hate to say like, this like web design is a solved problem thing again, but a lot of these stuff is like this is a pretty killer tool, and it takes a lot for me to kind of say that. And like,
I feel you. I mean, Trent was like saying stuff just like, it seems like for a brochure-ish looking site with that kind of, I don't know, a fairly standard design and some nav and simple, it's like, why do we need to code that from scratch again?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and like, you know, if you have like custom logic, like it doesn't offer that. Like if you need whatever geolocation of, you know, your company's stores, like 1850 locations or something like that, it doesn't do that. But maybe you could do some of that client side and it would. But anyway, all that to say, check out Webflow. I used it recently. I liked it enough. And
I wonder how, but did you hand it off to a client and you feel like it's fairly simple to like go fix typos and blog posts and stuff? Or
yeah, and that was actually maybe the best part was they were very into it. We set them up and invited them in early, and we're like, here's what we're thinking. Like this, we think this meets your needs. Cause we were kind of going off of their needs more than like what we like to do, which that was also a learning point. Just like, oh, if you listen to clients, things are different. You do things differently. But, we were very like, we need to like, we wanted to pick the right thing for, the woman managing the content, Caitlin. And so it was very important that she was on board with this, and she poked around and was just like, this is, I think, exactly what we want. And, so far, you know, and if they can feel comfortable editing content, well, howdy doody. Now you have another content loader when you need to like migrate content over.
I think a lot of people don't think of Webflow as a content, you know, like a CMS too, but it is through collections and stuff. Because what it is a very impressive like visual builder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has like this whole visual component. Like you like drag a div on there, and then you set the CSS of the div through like a properties panel, almost like you'd see in Photoshop or something, right? So you have like Photoshop control over each element, and then you kind of create these classes, kind of back to the atomic discussion. But you create these kind of classes that you name around these things, you know, and you can kind of modify and mm-hmm. whatever, like stack. It takes a little like learning because you're doing something new. But it's pretty cool. I mean, it's almost even sketchy. Can I say sketch? It's almost sketch like, cause you're like, you can use real data and like fill it with real data and then just start like kind of designing, and multiple things will kind of start taking shape as your...
That does seem impressive, that idea that you're not designing with lorem ipsum. It feels like you're about to, but then you connect the data to the things you're designing.
Well, and you hit publish and somebody can see it immediately. I mean, that's what's interesting too. And it's a website. So I think it works for prototypes. I think it works for, you know, like if you're doing like click-through mocks and you want to get like some user testing, I think it works great for that. I think it works great for client sites. I think it works great for kind of... you know, even like clients who want to update things, minor things pretty frequently. If you have somebody who just wants to like, you know, you have that client, quote unquote, that wants to like mess with the headline copy every week or every few days, this is a great tool for them. Let them do it.
So switching gears a little bit, I'm tempted to actually use Perch.
Okay. Which I think has kind of similar like editability, like you define the model.
Yeah, I actually haven't used it, but in my mind, it's seeming like the perfect thing. And I want to make sure that we do make the right choice, because I don't want, you know, 2 years from now to some other designer is picking this thing up from me being like, oh, why did we pick a kind of a, I don't know.
Like a niche sorry, CMS.
Rachel and stuff. Yeah, underdog kind of thing. But, you know, I'd make sure that it's not that, you know, that it's doing the job as simply and powerfully as we can. But I'm tempted to do it because there is a nice little admin and I can kind of do whatever I want with the CMS and just make sure that every little thing that you can see is just very obvious how to edit it. I think Perch can make that happen. And it has this e-commerce component to it. It has Perch Shop, which is important because right now, I didn't even get to the worst part, is that it's a WordPress site, but it's like half WordPress and half this third-party thing called Zen Planner, because they needed a calendar component to it and they needed to take credit cards as well for memberships to the gym. Mm. So it's like it's managed in entirely two different places, which I feel like is disconnected and feels weird. And
well, then in your situation, Perch is probably great just because it kind of has some of those features. And like,
yeah, and I think it's – yeah, I don't know that – I wouldn't even mind keeping it on WordPress either, but just really making it a lot simpler and less engineered than it is now, and then bringing the e-commerce stuff into WordPress too, so it's just all in one place. But, you know, as long as we're rebuilding it, it seems like we could do simpler. Mm-hmm. Perch just might be the ticket there.
Here, Ed Kraft writes in, hi, I'm in charge of building an online mortgage application, a 1003 app. I assume that's some sort of code on the web to be responsive. It's a gigantic form for all intents and purposes with plenty of error checking and form field validations. Any advice on handling such a mammoth task would be appreciated.
Oh, I'd use Woofoo probably. You know, and just get all that stuff for free. You may not be able to because it may not. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what your limitations are because it didn't. It didn't go here. But first of all, Ed, just psychologically, I'd try to get stoked over this thing. I'd try to be like, I'm going to make the best online mortgage application ever, and you know, just really put yourself in the shoes of someone who's filling out an online mortgage application and just make the best experience you possibly can. So, you know, lean into it, man.
just own it. I was going to say, if you're making a super form, yeah, you could use like any kind of form builder. Don't use Typeform. That would be the longest thing ever. Cloud4, Jason Grigsby, who is like known for taking one topic and deep diving as far as possible, he wrote a great post on autofill, what web devs should know but don't. A little pejorative, a little punchy there, Jason, but it's really great. It's basically like we have autofill and autocomplete attributes in HTML5 forms now. They don't work in every browser, but he tries to get this all kind of figured out and normalized. Sometimes the browser will care about the type of input. They'll care about the name of the input. They'll care about the autocomplete thing. But you could save users literally hundreds of hours a year if you did all these autocompletes correctly, in these autocomplete attributes. I'll give you here's Jason's chart of support. Chrome supports autocomplete. Opera supports autocomplete. Firefox, no. Edge, no. Safari's partial support. And mobile Safari as well.
So does it mean like my browser knows my name, so it fills out the...
Yeah, so like you'd hop into a form, you'd type like whatever, J, and then like boom, like it fills out the rest of the form. Even down to credit cards and things like that, which could be kind of a killer feature if you're like a e-commerce site. But it's sort of like, you know, there are some like you need to name your thing a certain thing to make some browsers happy, which you don't always have control over in some frameworks. But
so autofill would be sweet because it just helps them fill out the form faster, which is a UX consideration. So that would be another advice, Ed, is like, can you, before you start coding this thing and making choices on tech and stuff like that, maybe it would be good to wireframe it or just start from the UX perspective. Like, what is the awesomest thing we can possibly do for somebody filling out this form? Like, how can we make it easy? How can we make it useful? How can we suggest things to help? You know, what's the least amount of work they can do for the most bang for their buck backwards? And just start from that. Like, what's the absolute gold star, perfect, super trophy way to do this? And then make it happen.
Right. I would also say use as least JavaScript as possible. But you probably need some kind of validation on here. You probably need some HTML5 required things for accessibility, especially if you're doing a mortgage application. You're probably under like you have to do it accessible or you'll get sued sort of territory. So make sure you do that. There's a lot to think about there. So easy on the JavaScript is what I'd say. Because if that fails, people can't get a mortgage, and that's a big deal, right? So. But Jason has an example. It's a CodePen, and it's like cross-browser autofill form selected fields. Like, so it's got, you know, 20 fields here, all auto-completing. I'm going to go pop it into my Chrome and just see what happens. Live testing here on the Shop Talk Show. It has so far not auto-completed a single thing. Let's see. So, all right.
You have to train your browser to autocomplete too?
Yeah,
you'd have some settings.
Like, make sure it like figures stuff out. But I don't know. Anyway,
mine would be test with one password and make sure it fills in the stuff properly.
Yeah,
so I'm always hating on forms that my one password doesn't work on.
Oh, that's a huge deal. That's a huge deal. So yeah, I think yeah, no, I think this would be very important to figure out. Like if you're going to have a lot of redundant info, like, you know, make it, I don't know, fit, like do as much for the user as possible. You know, if they fill out their name in one screen, make sure that that name shows up in the next screen. You know, that's like my thing on a lot of things. It's like, you're asking for my name again. You're asking for my address again. Unless I like specify I have a different address, I usually have just one address, you know. I mean, Dave Rupert LLC is loaded, but I'm not like multiple houses loaded, you know. So, Chris, I think hopefully that helps. Ed, let us know if you make the killer form, send it our way. Chris, anything else? No, we should wrap it up.
ShopTalkShow.com. Well, you got to do the other stuff first.
False start on the offense. So thanks, everybody, for downloading. This is your podcast of choice. Rate it 5 stars. If you hate your shirt, go to our website. If you hate your job, go to our website. That's the quick version. Chris.
ShopTalkShow.com.
Yeah.